This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
This is the first time I've actually talked about this project that took about 3 years to do. And actually, I reread the catalog almost like a stranger yesterday to try and sort of get back into the world that we had to go into in order to do the project. And it was a very strange experience for me. It's the first time I've ever done this where I've had such an incredible amount of energy go into a project and then come back to it a couple of years later and try to really kind of re-engage with it in some way. And there were some interesting things, some things that, you know, still, you know, I guess I could say I'm proud of, and some things that were a real disappointment. And I would like to come back to some of those things later on, especially the disappointments. But basically, the form of this project, revisiting Gordon Maddock Clark's Fake Estates, was a two-part exhibition that took place at White Columns, which White Columns used to be 112 Green Street. It moved and was founded by Gordon Maddock Clark and Jeffrey Liu in the 1970s, and then morphed into White Columns. So it seemed like a great place to have this show. And then the other part of the show was the Queens Museum, because as you'll see, a lot of the bits of land that this project is around are in Queens. One of them is in Staten Island, but the majority of them are in Queens. And this entire project was around one artwork of Gordon Maddock Clark's. I say artwork with a lot of hesitation because we're not sure what this project was. And that was one of the interesting things with the project, was that every time there was a document, every time someone made a statement, someone else made a counter-statement, everything became more and more wobbly. Every document seemed to have some point in it where you could begin to doubt it. And at the end of the project, we really didn't know how to present this information, but nothing ever was foundational or trustworthy fully. So whether this is an artwork, whether Gordon Maddock Clark ever exhibited it, what the fate of it would have been under him, whether he's the author of it in some deep sense, all of these things became more and more open in some sense. And that was exciting, as well as being very, very difficult for us as the project went on. And I'll come back to some of these issues. And in addition to the exhibition, we also produced a catalog which has some essays in it, in addition to the work of the 16 artists that we asked to respond to the Gordon Maddock Clark project. And then in addition to that, there were tours to the original sites, to the sites in Queens, and I'll show you a little bit of that as well. I didn't come up with a title for today's talk, but I think the question of genesis or origin is actually very interesting for this particular project, partly because of the things I've already mentioned, where the question of origin, genesis, teleology, conclusion, authorship, all of these things were really, as I said, became more and more in a place of suspension or something like that by the end of the project. So what I'd like to do is talk about three origins. One is the origins of our interest in it, and I'll show you where we came from. We didn't come to this project from Gordon Maddock Clark, or some very different. I'll show you that. The origins of these strange slivers of land. Why is it that these strange slivers of land even exist? Because he bought 15 of them, which I'll show you, but there are thousands of them all over Queens, Staten Island, etc. And that's a question of urbanism and the fate of these particular bits of land in Queens. And the third one is the origins of Maddock Clark's own project and the kinds of forces that fed into him doing this work and the ways in which actually he sort of himself put it in a box and forgot about it and what happened with that particular project there. So we came to the project through something completely sort of sideways, which is that we did an issue on property. Issue 10 of the magazine, Cabinet magazine, was on property. And Cabinet is run on a shoestring budget, and we wanted to know if you had a budget of a few hundred dollars, how much land could we get in America? So it was kind of a strange expedition to try and find cheap land. And on eBay, so we actually ended up buying land in three places: Queens, Luna County, and Mars. I'll tell you about Luna County first. We bought this half-acre piece of land outside of Deming, New Mexico, on eBay. We bought it for $325, and that's because it looks like this. And we bought it sight unseen, and in order to have pictures in the magazine, I had to cold call all the residents of Deming until I found somebody who was very nice and said, I'll drive 10 miles and take pictures of this land for you. And that's a picture that this very nice guy took for us. And we decided to, that's our deed, just to prove to you that we own it. That's a satellite picture of the land. And for that one, what we did is we divided the land into a very nepotistic and narcissistic territory called Cabinetlandia. There's a section called Nepotismia, where we sort of give away land to people we like. There's a section called Funderlandia, where people who fund the magazine get little bits of land. And we have a section called Readerland, and we had a contract in the magazine, and you could buy a little tiny piece of land exactly the size of the magazine for one penny. And thousands of people claimed it, so that bit of land is sort of quite busy these days. And we have three project lands, and we commission different kinds of projects on them. This is the post box that we put up there. And three of our subscribers went and bought, went and made this, which is looks like a file cabinet to you, but it's actually the Cabinet National Library. And that's still going on. And all the issues of the magazine, all the books that we do, all our projects are very well documented there. So that's the filing cabinet. That's the top filing cabinet there. For $35, we bought some land in on Mars. That's our deed from a guy who says he's authorized to sell land on Mars. You can find him on online very easily. And this is the land that he sold us. So this is how we came to this very serious project about Gordon Matter Clark. And we all knew about this project of his, and we wondered what had happened to these bits of land. And I'll show you what those bits of land were that Gordon Matter Clark bought. Now, here it says 15 bits of land. Officially, when we started the project, there were 14 bits of land that he had bought. It turned out that there was a sort of a lost, forgotten 15th bit of land that we actually, in our research, found. So the ultimate artworks that were sold to museums look like this. And what they are these collages. There are 14 of them. As I said, the 15th one was sort of lost. And some of them are displayable and some of them are not. And this is a displayable one, obviously, by definition. You're seeing it. And the three elements are always the same. One or multiple photographs of the site that he bought. A land, a map of the land that the city of New York still gives to you today. They look exactly the same if you want to go buy a piece of land. It looks like that. And in red is a sliver that he owns. And already you start to get a sense of why these slivers are very unusual, and that's his deed. He went to two auctions in October, and I can't remember now. Nope, they're both in October, 1973, and at auction bought the 15 bits of land. I'll show you another. Some of the collages are unwieldy because what he did is, if a strip of land was very long, he took lots and lots of pictures like this, and he would put a panorama together, as it were, of all the bits of land put together. This is just the ground. And some of them are 250 feet long. Some of them, the plots of land are 250 feet long, and he has 250 feet worth of photographs. So those can never be displayed, by, you know, obviously. So some of them have never been seen, if you like, framed. So this is what we ended up, this is what he ended up with. These collages, these artworks, sold as 14 separate artworks. They're called Reality Properties Fake Estates. We found that there was really no basis for this name, but I'll come back to that as well. But that's what they're called. So when we wanted to buy land, we wondered what had happened to these 14 bits of land that became these, you know, that Matter Clark had bought for these artworks. And we had an intern, Christine Potts, who went out and found all of them. She went to the Queen's Registry and looked up, you know, because the original deeds, if you remember, in the Matter Clark, you can sort of see what the block and lot is there. So she went and found them, and we all went out and photographed them. So here is one of them today, and it's 2.77 feet by 100 feet, and it runs right down the middle of this person's garden, right down the middle of the lawn. That's where one of them is. This one is just this triangular wedge of sort of leaves and grass. What's going on? Is the iguana free? Is that the bit of the skin? Oh, no. That's terrible. Should I go on? Is that unethical? The iguana gets very cold, apparently. Really? Okay. So this is another piece of land, 2.64 by 20 by 20 feet, and it's this triangular strip of land outside of the fence. This is another one down the middle of this driveway with those dimensions. This one is all along this wall. This one is all along the wall on the left. These are, you know, separate pieces of property, obviously. This one is an internal site. You cannot get to it. You would have to parachute in from the top. It's behind. You can't see it from here. It's between four buildings. And Matta Clark was especially interested and excited by these inaccessible bits of land because, as he said at one point, to own something and never be able to see it, experience it, or use it, what could be more beautiful than that? So these were the ones he was especially excited by. This is down the middle of this driveway. You get the idea. This one, I don't remember where it is, actually. Skip past that one. That's that bush. And this one is an internal one again, behind those buildings. We actually couldn't get any further than that one. Internal one again, and on. You get the idea. And we found out that from the 14 bits of land, what had happened is that these bills had come in 1978, 79 for Matta Clark, and then he died in 78 for his widow, who didn't know about this project that had happened earlier. He had bought these in 1973, and Jane Crawford had met Matta Clark in 1976. So Matta Clark was ill with pancreatic cancer. He died in 78 from that. The bills come at that time. Everybody ignores them. And then when he dies, Jane Crawford didn't know what these bills were at all, and she ignored them as well. And what happened is the city repossessed all 14 bits of land. And from the 14, four had been bought by people next door who realized, for example, that in the middle of my garden suddenly there's a sliver that doesn't belong to me, etc. But 10 of them were available. And we went to the city and we asked them if we could buy the 10 properties. They said, sure. And they came back after a month and said, no, why? Why these strange bits of land? They're useless. Why do you want to do with them? And we went back and forth, and they said, no, we won't sell them to you. Why do you want them? And finally, we said, well, there was this artwork that originally involved the purchase of these bits of land by this guy called Gordon Matta Clark. And the minute they heard artwork, they kind of they were less interested, actually. But then somebody we knew intervened, and Mayor Bloomberg, in fact, finally said it was okay for them to license us the bits of land. Not even lease, but license. Licensing allowing them to throw us off the land whenever they want if we do something they don't like. So it gave us the minimum amount of power over the land. And the license is a wonderful, wonderful thing. It came, this huge document, and on it there was a special line added that we can only have a paper conceptual relationship to the land. That's what it said. I don't know who came up with those words, but we were not allowed to do anything on the land. We were not allowed to build anything, do anything permanent. We're allowed to go onto it if we could go onto it. You know, some of them, as I said, were internal sites and you can't even get to them. So that's how we ended up licensing 10 of these things for our issue on property. And so we spent our few hundred dollars and got all these bits of land. They were $125 a year for all 10 bits of land. That's what the price was. I don't know how they decided that. So, and then what we did is we asked three artists to do projects on them. So remember this one, Jimbo Blatchley proposed this crazy scheme of putting parking meters there. This is in the middle of Queens, you know. And there were going to be exorbitant fees charged, for parking your car there. And he was going to take the money and get this building up there that he wants in Harlem for his studio. So it was all a sort of get-rich-quick scheme based around fleecing these poor people in Queens. That was his idea. Matthew Northridge had an internal site, but they could choose their sites, and he had this blue cottage that was going to be elevated exactly the same size, sort of going all the way up into the ceiling. And the third one was Clara Williams. Okay, good, the names there. And for this bit of land, she suggested putting this mailbox that says nobody there. So these were conceptual things, and we just had them in the magazine. That was the end of it. So we were done with the project, we thought. And then we started to sort of think about the project, and we thought it'd be kind of interesting to actually propose more artworks for the land and actually maybe even do something on the land. And that's when we called Jane Crawford again. We'd sort of talked to her very briefly during this sort of first phase and started to ask her some more questions about this. And that's when it got really interesting. Let me show you. There were all these documents that no one had ever seen, and some of them are just cool things, like this amazing drawing the Matta Clark did of the shapes of these things on a little manila folder. And then we bumped into a film, which I want to show you in a second. But there was a folder, and in this folder that she had gotten, she didn't have this folder when Matta Clark died. What she'd gotten were the tax bills, and she didn't know what they were for. But the folder with all the things in it, Matta Clark's deeds, his photographs, etc., had been given by Matta Clark to a friend of his called Norman Fisher. And then Fisher died, and then someone else took it over. And finally, in 1979, the widow gets this box, and it's got all these things in it, and she has no idea what they are. And she put it away and forgot all about it until 1992. So this artwork, if you like, was in suspension until 1992, when a curator from EVOM, who was doing the first retrospective of Matta Clark, opens the box and says, this is very interesting, we should form a collage of these things. And that's when the idea of those collages came about for the first time. And then we found that Matta Clark had actually visited these sites. Nobody had seen this film before, but a good friend of his, Jaime Davidovich, had gone there in 1975, once had bought the bits of land with Matta Clark, and had gone there with his enormous porta-pack and had filmed Matta Clark measuring and measuring the bits of land and talking to the neighbors. So, Aaron, can we see the film?
Well, I think the only way to do is to try to pace it off to from the corner over there. Chalk line here is this intersection of between lot 53 and 55. So the property is somewhere. The property would start somewhere 100 and well, the full lot length is 100 feet to the very back. The property we're going to have to locate the property 56.42 feet. From this point back, okay? So it's back in that direction over there. Let's look in this one.
Get me out of the picture, please. I don't want to get in the picture. It's none of your business about it.
Back there?
That is.
you both 10 years.
Yeah, no, I've been only used in the morning and later when the sun does. It closes to me.
So, Markov, this is real easy to do. That's fine enough.
This plot, by the way, is the one with the parking meters on it. It's that one there. So we started to bump into all this extra material related to the project, and what got us very interested was the fact that all the people we started to talk to, especially people from Ann Architecture, you know, that was the group that Matta Clark was hanging out with in the 70s, Richard Nonis, Gene Heistein, Laurie Anderson, etc., they all started to tell us very different things about what this project was supposed to be as far as Matta Clark was concerned. Some people said, well, for him, it was just a project that he would pull out at parties and show people. It was not meant to be an artwork of any kind. It was just the kind of a thing he always had under the dinner table. Some people said it was shown at 112 Green Street, but now I'm not so sure anymore, but I'm pretty sure it was shown there. And he wanted to commission public artworks, like a miniature sculpture park, to be built on each of these things. Another answer that came was that he just wanted it for a conceptual artwork. He didn't want to build anything. He thought that would be the wrong thing to do. But he never knew quite what to do with it, which is why he gave the whole box to this friend of his and said, keep it. I don't know what to do with these things. All these different answers came about. And then when we talked to Jane Crawford, we said, you know, reality properties, fake estates, where does this name come from? And she said, well, it's called realty properties. And we said, well, actually, in this catalog, this catalog, this catalog, this catalog, is called reality properties. And she said, oh my God, there's an I there. And we realized that it's called Realty Positions in a show in 1994 at Hollywood Solomon Gallery, that all these different names were circulating around this. The Guggenheim, for example, had bought one of these collages, and if you look on their website now, it says assembled posthumously in 1992, which is true. They give a date for the artwork for 1974. We didn't understand why 1974. He bought the bits of land in 1973. Nothing happened in 1974. Nothing happened in 1975. on and on and on. If you look at all the different institutions that own these things, all of them have different dates, all of them have inconsistent names, and it just seemed like an incredible morass of information that didn't add up. And that was very interesting to us because we were wondering how it is that each one of them, something like the author function had been mobilized in the case of each one of these things to come up with a neat set of parameters that these museums needed in order to first buy it, then put it into their catalogs, and then possibly sell it on. But as I said, there was inconsistency all throughout. One date said 1992, and Matta Clark had been dead for many years in 1992. So partly out of these inconsistencies and wanting to find out how it was that these inconsistencies had been produced and then undermined, as it were, and sort of everything being recollected into a unified thing. And then partly because we got very interested in another question we sort of ignored, namely, why did these bits of land come about anyway? Why create these bits of land? I mean, we'd gotten the story from the city, and the more we looked at it, the more this did not fit what had happened in Queens. And we started talking to a Queens historian who basically said, no, that makes no sense what the city itself has told you about them. Because of these two reasons in particular, we decided to do this further project. And to start off with, we wanted to commission artists to make artworks responding to this that we were going to put on the bits of land. We finally changed our minds, and we decided a lighter footprint is the way to go, in order to keep this project as open as possible. There was a kind of openness to it, and I felt like putting a sculpture actually there would undermine this openness. But to go back to the question of why did these bits of land exist in the first place? When we had called the city to begin with, when we said, can we buy these bits of land, we talked to some people there, and they said, these bits of land came about because surveyors make errors. So they start at one end, another person starts at this end, they don't line up. There's suddenly 2 feet left over, and they go, well, let's just make a plot that's 2 feet by 100 feet. You know? That seemed sort of understandable in some ways. Although still, you would say, why can't they just say this 2 feet then gets added to that lot to the right or to the left? And why are we going to leave this totally useless bit of land legally just staying there in the middle? But it turned out that actually that was not the case. There were not surveyor's errors. As I said, there were thousands of them. And most of them in Queens were produced out of two moments. One in the 1930s, if you look at the dates of these things, if you go into the records, and some of them in the 1930s, some of them 1960s. The ones in the 1930s were mainly produced out of rural land that didn't have a grid on it, having suddenly a grid imposed on it. And the farmland had followed topology. And when you put a grid on it, sometimes there were little slivers left over that didn't fit. And they did their best to make those into regular little squares, but sometimes there were little things left over again, and they would just create a little tiny bit of land off of that. And then in the 1960s, what happened is that Moses came along. And Moses, as he imposed, say, a highway that would cut across an entire block, sometimes a little bit of land, a triangle, would be left on the other side of the highway. And they would do their best again, but there would be something left over again. And sometimes, I mean, a lot of what happened with Moses is that there were plans made, and the highway never got built, but the land got divided anyway. And what I'd like to show you, so these are the maps that you get when you go into the city archives. And the maps, every 30 years or so, the maps are reprinted. But what happens in between is that they hand draw on there all the changes that happened. And when the map gets reprinted 30 years later, all the changes get incorporated on there. And they have this amazing color coding system of these different colors of pencils to show you what happened first, then second, then third, then fourth. So what we did is two of the people working on the project with us, by the way, I should say that the project was co-curated by three people, Francis Richard, Jeffrey Kastner, and myself, and we had lots of help from different people at the magazine. So what happened is that we went into these maps and we undid the lines one by one to see how these bits of land were created. You can actually do this for every set of maps and create the exact blow by blow of how these things were produced. And the question that was asked at the end of that one, you could ask for all of them, why? Why leave that little sliver there? Why not just add it to the lot next to it? and a lot of them were cut off. I mean, so you know, you can do all this research and still end up asking, but it makes no sense. We worked with a historian of Queens, Jeffrey Kressler, who wrote an essay and in the catalog, and he helped us, you know, understand sort of these moves on these maps. And we got very fascinated by this level of detail. You know, we would call each other up at 2 in the morning and go, you know, Lot 148. I found out, you know, this and that about it. But so we wanted to sort of, part of the show was about the history of urbanism and exactly what went on here. The other part of urbanism we got very interested in is, why did the city sell these lots in 1973? And they wouldn't sell it to us ever again. You know, they said that actually these kinds of lots are never going to be sold again. That's it. They just want to hold on to them. And it turned out to be an interesting sort of moment to look at, you know, urbanism in New York City, because the city had gone bankrupt in 1973. And they were selling every little thing that they had. And at that time, according to Kressler, and you know, he shows exactly how this happens, the city was not run like the corporation it is today. So they were bankrupt, and their idea was sell everything we've got. And they were printing these auction catalogs, and they were putting up for sale all these micro slivers as well. And they weren't doing the kinds of calculations they do now, where they say, it's going to cost us $150 in bureaucracy just to put up this thing, you know, print it in the auction catalog, take the deed, register it, mail it to the person, collect the taxes, on and on and on. It wasn't going to be worth it to them. But they didn't do that kind of calculation back then. So for $25 to $75, Matta Clark ends up with all of these things. He goes to these two auctions, as I mentioned. One of them goes for $300, and he gets outbid. And the reason why we know that is that a guy from the New York Times is there at the auction doing a fun piece about the slivers, and he says, there was also this weird guy who's an artist called Gordon Matta Clark, and he interviews Matta Clark there, and we know he was beaten at the auction for one sliver, only one sliver. The other ones, nobody wanted. The reason why that guy wanted the $300 sliver is that he owned a horrible, useless sliver next to it, and he thought if he put the two together, he could sell it as one garden to the guy next door. So that's sort of what he had in mind. We don't know if it worked out for that guy or not, but that's what he had. And there, Matta Clark, in that little interview with the New York Times, it's the one statement he makes about the uses of it. He says, I think I'm going to make an artwork out of it. I think what I'd like to do is have the deed, the photographs I'm going to take, a list of the weeds growing on these bits of land, and the land itself altogether as an artwork. But I haven't really thought about it that much. So for him, it seemed to be that you got the land as well when you bought the deed. So one statement he makes about it that's explicit about the uses of it. So then let me just show you. I'm going to finish 5 minutes. So this was at White Columns. We commissioned 16 artists to respond to the original artwork in some way. And show you details. This is Mark Dion's Gordon Matta Clark Subterranean Museum. And it's exactly the size of one of the bits of land. And it goes down. And you've got all the kind of infrastructure of the city that Matta Clark himself was obsessed with. He loved the underground. He loved the sewage system. You know, these were, you know, spaces that Matta Clark was fascinated with. This is what it looked like, the actual model that he made. This was Isidro Blasco, who went to one of the lots and took this sort of blasted, fragmented picture. This is Valerie Hegarty, roses erupting out of the wall. This actually is Tupperware, and it's the size, these are Tupperware containers. That's the size of one of the lots. And Tupperware, the leftover food, turned out was invented the year that Matta Clark was born. So somehow these leftover bits of land and the leftover food was what this piece was about. This is Katrin Sigurdardottir, and this is a box that unfolds to represent the slivers of land, each one of them in a different way. This is Meryl Euclides, who worked with bakers next to three sites, three bits of land, to create pastries that are in the shapes of those bits of land. And each day, one of the bakers would come with his special baklavas and things like this in celebration of this crazy bit of land. And the little poster you see bottom left is interesting because that's a show that she and Matta Clark were in together. And in fact, Matta Clark is to the left. That's a piece by Matta Clark there. And I think I'm just going to actually, let's see. Well, this is the Queen's Museum installation. We had on the panorama there all the bits of land marked out, and you can see the history of each bit of land. So that's what that looked like there. And then we did something that we wanted to visit these bits of land, and so we did it through a series of tours. The first one is with Jaime Davidovich. Jaime Davidovich is the artist who shot the video that you saw, the trip in 1975. He's an Argentinian filmmaker, video maker, and he had one of the first port-a-packs in the city, and he still lives in the exact same building he lived in back then on Wooster Street, right in front of Gordon Matta Clark's building. So Matta Clark was at 155 Wooster Street. Jaime still owns Fluxus Building Number 2, which is where he lived, right in front of that. And we're very good friends. They're always passing things back onto each other, etc. And he took us on the first tour there. And he hadn't been to these sites since 1975. And this was actually the driveway that Jimbo Blatchley had suggested putting the parking meters in. We showed up, and there was a garage sale. All the garages had opened up for a garage sale. So this busload of, well, you know, frankly, Manhattan art people, you know, show up with this whole apparatus. This is Robert Fiore here, who made all the Smithson films. He's there filming this whole thing. And suddenly the garage people are like, fantastic, you've all come. And we had an interesting sort of, it was a very nice Gordon Matta Clark moment, I think. I mean, I think of him as overlapping these kind of interstitial spaces so beautifully in his work. And this was a fantastic moment. Where suddenly people were shopping and picking up stuff. And anyway, this was the second tour. This is Jimbo Blatchley on the right and Lytle Shaw on the left. And they did a tour trying to see what kind of influences living in Ithaca, this upstate Hellenism as they called it, had on Matta Clark's early work. And they produced this sort of fake genealogy of Matta Clark coming out of this upstate Hellenism and redefining modernism through this these kinds of obsessions that you get if you live in a place called Ithaca, but upstate New York. This is them showing one of these fake Matta Clarks. They created all these fake Matta Clark artworks for the show for the tour. So these were buses, and they went to a number of sites. Oh, I thought there was going to be Mark Dion, who did a tour with two naturalist friends of his, and it was a tour of the flora and fauna, perhaps going back to the weeds that Matta Clark had mentioned. But it was a tour of the sites and the kinds of things that grow there and the kinds of animals that are there. And then the last tour was Nato Thompson, who was a curator, and I'm just going to show a tiny bit of that. And his idea was that the whole show was a horrible mistake, that, in fact, we'd misunderstood that these were sites of crime for Matta Clark, that these little microslivers were somehow associated with some dirty, dirty secret. And let's see if I can play this. Okay, let's do it from here.
The first mood, if you will, corresponds to your red...
Sorry, I should also say that his tour was based around a series of moods, each one associated with a color and a filtered piece of filter he would give to everybody to wear. So.
Red gel. I'll start my music now. The word for this tour right now is called Out of Sight, Out of Mind. Investigations into the criminal potential of Gordon Matta Clark's lost lots. Gordon Matta Clark is an important artist, was an important artist. But as we all know, it doesn't mean everything you find in their house is an important piece of art. I'd like to propose to you that this exhibition on Gordon Matta Clark's odd lots is a horrific mistake. That in fact, as opposed to being an interesting conceptual work about public space and private space, what was found underneath a bed in an unmarked box with photographs, deeds, charts, were clues to a heinous crime. Gordon Matta Clark finding places to bury the dead.
Oh, that's a great idea. Huh? That's great.
Even a cursory look around the borough of Queens says one thing to you. There's a lot of dead people in Queens. Queens is pockmarked with cemeteries left and right. Look around you. Look in the world. I invite you to look for places to bury your dead. I'm not saying that Gordon Manaclar killed 15 people. That's not where I'm... Why I'm here. Oh, come here. Sorry, guys. I got a lot of things going here. Wait. Not for me to say that Gordon Manaclar killed 15 people, but I'm going to say that he probably...
Stop it there. Anyway, you get a sense of the kinds of tours that we set up around it. Maybe I'll stop there and... questions or thoughts or comments or etc.
Close this.
Sorry?
What was he going to say with the DVD? It's not that he killed them.
He wanted to bury them, but there were bodies that he himself wasn't responsible for. Yeah. We're going to put these online, all the tours. We've shot the whole thing. And we're going to put them online. So they will be online if you're interested in them. They're all four very different takes on the thing. Yeah?
The painter was well chairman of the painting department here for a while, maybe in the 80s or something, maybe in the 70s. And he had a farm up in Maine. The power company was building a bunch of power lines across the land he wanted to stop. So they didn't give them an easement, and they redirected their power lines a little further, let's say, to the north. And he continued to buy a strip of land that was about 1 foot wide and about a half a mile to a mile long. I can't remember now. But the point of it was he had this enormous piece of land that he bought primarily just to stop the power company.
I see. Interesting.
Power projects or land companies.
Right. Actually, what's happened with our piece of land in New Mexico is that the Luna County is trying to get all these half-acre ranchettes, as they're called. This guy bought all this land back in the 60s and cut it up into half-acre ranchettes. And they've been sort of being, you know, that's what we have, one of these half-acre ranchettes. It was a get-rich-quick scheme that this guy came up with. Luna County is trying to buy them all back in order to consolidate them and actually do something now with that land. But all these people like us own them. And we have subdivided again our bit of land into thousands of legal tiny bits. So it's going to be very hard for them to gather all this stuff up. And then we found out once we'd done the project, the Manfred Mann, who's a pop star, you know, singer from the 70s in England, he had done exactly the same thing, where you could get a piece of land exactly the size of the LP with a contract in it for this land in Wales that he loved, and he didn't want to have it be developed. And in fact, they just had the anniversary of this project, because everything around that part of Wales has been developed except for this bit of land that Manfred Mann bought up and divided into these tiny sections. So our cool project turned out to be a 30-year-old project by Manfred Mann. Yes? They didn't even know, most of them, that there was a separate piece of land.
Right.
Like,
so
yeah.
It was kind of integrated, I mean. But was there any kind of, were there any people in the neighborhoods who were aware of the history?
Not of the history of the bits of land. What happened is that the kind of reaction that you saw Matt Clark getting, you know, with people coming out, and they're of course upset, we had some of the same. So we were taking pictures, for example, of a lot down the guy's garden, you know. And he came out and said, "What are you doing?" And, you know, you don't, I mean, we weren't interested in asserting our property rights. You know, we wanted to just take the picture, basically. So we did our best to kind of, you know, say we just want to take a picture. But then, of course, at some point you have to say something because he thinks you're taking a picture of his land, you know, of his house. So with some people we said, actually, we have licensed this little bit of land from the city. One person did know about the bits of land and said, you must be from the city, because the city apparently sends someone out to his little extra, like at the back of his garden he had some extra little section. It was an internal lot, and apparently the city sends someone out every so often to check to make sure he hasn't, like, yeah, taken over this, like, pathetic bit of land. It must cost the city so much to administer this stuff, you know? On the whole, people didn't know about it at all. The 15th piece of land was very interesting. When we found that 15th piece of land, the reason why it went missing is that Matta Clark gave it as a gift to Jaime Davidovich. And when we sort of hooked up with Jaime, and at one point we said, you know, there was this sort of 15th thing, and he goes, oh, I have it. And so we called Jane Crawford and said, we found your 15th bit of land. The reason why you didn't have the deed, she had some bits and pieces, enough to know there's a 15th, but not the whole set of documentation required, you know, just like the other ones. So he had the deed, etc. That one we went to is in Queens, and that one is a triangular shape, which is at the end of a warehouse, but just inside of it. And these people opened up sort of this chicken wire sort of door, and they didn't open up the whole thing. It was like we were talking through this fence with them, and we said, you know, can we come and take a picture of this bit of land here? And they were, like, very, very upset, you know, about this. And so we had all kinds of reactions, but on the whole, people didn't know about the bits of land, no. I think if they did, they would have sort of tried to get them when they were available from the city, you know? Why not go and just buy it to make sure? Yeah?
So the attempts to reacquire them have pretty much been exhausted. It's not really a possibility.
It's not possible to buy them anymore. The city says, the city told us, they're trying to come up with a global solution for these bits of land. I actually don't know what a global solution would mean, other than one person conceptually buying all of them, maybe, saying, I want all these crazy bits of land, I'll give you $1 million for all, you know, whatever it is, 1,000, you know, 5,000, whatever it is, you know. But I don't know what a global solution would be. And so I think at this point, as I said, like thinking like a corporation, they've realized that it's better to just let them be. I mean, they should just gift it to the people next door or something, but they're just sitting there. They don't want to sell them, though.
There's this debate going on in rural Massachusetts right now about a dune scape that Edward Hopper is in, and somebody wants to build a big house there, and so they're going to destroy the dunes. And I read this editorial that said, you know, it's not really about the dunes, it's about the painting. But in this case, I guess my question is, in your opinion, is it about the land? Is the artwork somehow incomplete, that the land isn't really part, you know, the Guggenheim doesn't actually own anything?
I see. When the Generali Foundation in Austria, which owns one of the collages, found out that we have them, they asked us if they could buy the land. For them, somehow owning the land was important. And at the Guggenheim also, somebody inquired whether they could possibly buy the land. But, you know, this artwork has come to be defined posthumously to be those collages. So the idea of the land, owning the land being part of the work in some ways, I don't think, and those were unusual requests, I think, you know. Well, my personal opinion is that if these one artwork, all 14 of them, or 14 artworks. Of course, if you want to make money, there are 14 artworks. You know, all the people we knew who talked to him at the time about it, sort of felt that he thought of it as one project, not 14 separate projects. And seriality and repetition and this kind of the gesture unfolding again and again, they thought was very much part of it. So who made the decision to say these are 14 artworks? Probably somebody who had, you know, financial stakes here. Secondly, who decided to call this title? As I said, you know, all of these things, from the date to the title to, you know, all of these things were posthumously done. Is it an amazing project? Yes, it's an amazing project. Is it an artwork? I don't know. Who cares in some ways, you know, because it. You know, it's amazing for a couple of reasons in itself, but also in relation to the rest of Matta Clark's work, because it undermines this kind of, as we put in the catalog, this kind of chainsaw wielding, you know, macho tool belt conceptualist this is a very, very different kind of project, you know? It's actually one of my favorite projects of his because of this, but this kind of dryness, this low footprint it leaves is so, you know, different, I think, in some ways. And also, I think, interesting to read against the other works. Artwork or not, I don't know. Yeah. Owning the land is cool in some ways, you know, it's like, it feels special. Because the city at that time when we were licensing it, when they did license the 10 to us, said, we have other ones like them too. And, you know, like, should we just license another 20? And then somehow, you know, whatever. The hagiography was slightly, was enough for us to go, no, we want those 10. Those are somehow hallowed in some way. We fell prey to that ourselves. So. Yeah.
I guess I want to thank you and the other two curators you mentioned, because I, for Mountain Magic, because I saw it, I went with my mom, and I had just started a job in the like two-person property acquisition department for a little housing nonprofit here in Philadelphia, and I had to do a lot of like deed stuff, and there were all sorts of messed up stuff like this, and a lot of really dry things, and I came back to my job, and
yeah.
And I guess I was trying to figure out how to make this a question. I don't know, maybe other people could just, if anybody has any reactions to it, but I think in New York, there's these little slivers of property are kind of neutral and lighthearted. I think it's bureaucratic, whatever reasons. But I think what I learned from my job here in Philly, there are sort of similar things, but it's much more poignant because this city lost, you know, this city was hit so much harder than New York, and so many people left and died, and there were all these properties that people are just gone, kids are, you know, nowhere to be found, and sometimes they are a hindrance to kind of redevelop them in the neighborhood because you can't build them as these. There's this, you know, not a sliver, but a little row home lot that somebody is, just totally unknown in the city for the same bureaucratic reasons, they won't, you know, seize it. Or there are things that could be done, but there's all these other, you know, real property issues in Philadelphia, which I think have a much kind of sadder.
Yeah. Well, to go back to your point about the visits, one of the things behind the work that Matta Clark did is that in 1973 is also the moment of sort of this kind of loft culture, and there, every single person we talked to said, you know, Matta Clark and all of us were going down to the city agencies again and again to get this kind of permit, that kind of permit. You know, they were doing things that were quasi-legal, and they were down in these agencies all the time looking through these kinds of records, trying to see who owns this property, can I, in fact, you know, live there, blah, blah, blah. So apparently Matta Clark was the only person who loved going through these kinds of records. He would like being there. And I can't remember, I think it's Carol Gooden said, he was the only person who would always come back with something. He would go back, you know, downtown and would come back with some document that he would like show everybody. So he loved this world, very different from the Matta Clark that, you know, the better known Matta Clark, you know, but he loved this kind of archival research as well. And I underestimated a couple of other things. One is Alana Heiss, who the founder of PS1, that was a work with Matta Clark quite a bit. And she's the one who told him about these particular bits of land, because she was going to auctions trying to buy something in Queens that would later become PS1. And she was running the Institute for Art and Urban Resources and then had done a couple of shows with Matta Clark, who were very good friends. And she told him about the bits of land, and he immediately, you know, wanted to go to the auctions. So it's sort of this loft culture, Alana Heiss, and then Anne Architecture, which I mentioned, are three of the main forces behind this work. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. All of these documents, which without this systematic kind of institutional belief in the institution, are meaningless.
Mm-hmm.
And so, was there ever an idea of like wanting to include include some bit of cement or something from the actual.
For us or for Jane?
I mean, I guess for Jane, and then when they were first shown in 92, when it kind of they became the artwork and became being shown, you know, was that ever, did you talk to people about why?
No, I don't know why this, you know, the collage and these particular, you know, why these three elements, the photograph, the deed, and the map, you know, why that. For example, there were tax bills in there, pay tax bills, and she decided to exclude those as well. So it wasn't just material versus documentation, you know, because some documents were left out as well. I'm not sure. No. Sorry?
I have this my experience with your project. I teach a course, it's called Space and Political Imagination, and every semester, either I bring the group project up or some students bring it up. And then what happens in the classroom is pretty odd. Like people, we start talking about the project, and people start describing what it is, and how it was done, all the little things that you've been describing. But then somehow, nothing happens beyond that, and I always wonder what it was about. You couldn't really, like, come up with anything in the classroom. And then it seemed to me eventually what I thought it was, and I'm not sure, but I wanted to know your opinion about it, is that it basically was a very successful artwork in the way of the collective artwork you created, in that it was a space of contemplation.
Mm-hmm.
It actually provoked this sort of sense in the classroom.
Absolutely.
That it was actually contemplating something,
mm-hmm.
and having it sort of, it was a very quiet project,
mm-hmm.
and there was just a repetition of what it was, but without any desire to go beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was pretty striking, but it took me like two times.
Yeah.
To actually get that that was happening, because you know, the attempt to, you know, get the conclusions or theorize was not working.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Did you get that sense when you were working on it? I was very struck by that.
Yeah. Well, the decision to not put artworks on the land, even if it's small artworks, was part of this idea. You know, the light footprint I was mentioning, part of their impulse behind that was to leave it open and a space for contemplation still. And there's a kind of poetics in this piece that I think would be drained once you go to the land and you're like, oh, here's a sculpture on the land, you know, in that sense, that, you know, it sort of leaves it still in a kind of a literary mode, I think, when you don't do that. And the second thing is that an architecture, which, you know, is the poster showed you this letter that he sent from Europe to his colleagues in an architecture, and in there he has a whole lot of ideas, and number 7 says, you know, fake estates. He'd already bought these things, and he says, you know, with some projections for ideas, blah, 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 on them. He doesn't get very specific, but he mentions there. But an architecture, you know, part of what they were fascinated with were things like voids and liminal spaces and kind of negative spaces in some ways, you know. And in that sense, I think this is a perfect an architecture project. And how do you leave the void a void and not fill it, right? And I think this is exactly right. I mean, that's why it can keep going, because it is a void. Perhaps in someone's finishing it, naming it, titling it, giving it a date, if he'd ever done this, would in some ways have perhaps have exhausted it in some way. And it does seem inexhaustible, partly because of its unfinished status too. Perhaps it's the right destination for it in some ways.
I was going to say,
yeah?
Earlier you said, Matt, that this is kind of an odd work for Matt Clark against the rest of his work. But I think precisely in light of what you said about this being a void space, that it's actually absolutely very...
Oh, yeah, no. Oh, absolutely. Yes.
To me, it seems like the splitting version on an urban planning scale.
Yeah.
That these slivers, these void pieces of land, that if he purchases them, then they're totally resistant or to any kind of modification by any other kind of normal structure on the land.
Absolutely. No, I think, I mean, that's why I said it's interesting to read them against each other. That it's not a piece completely, you know, in its own orbit. But the means, the materials, the economy of it, all of that is different, you know? I mean, bits of paper, et cetera, you know, as opposed to doing
right.
the thing, you know? So that's what I mean. The materials and the approach is different. But, of course, the obsessions and the framework are very similar with the splittings. And
I mean, do you think there was any sort of political agenda here?
Here?
Anti-institutional,
well,
something about Mara Clark wanting to give the finger to the institution of owning land, that government owns this piece of land and creates all these kind of residual spaces that go unaccounted for, and maybe there's a message of waste.
Maybe. Of course, he was interested in waste.
Absolutely.
Jane Crawford says that in a very, very... Jane was not the only person to say this, but he was actually very interested in this idea of owning property, landed gentry. I mean, he comes from... You know, his godfather is Marcel Duchamp. His father is this famous surrealist. He comes from aristocracy in some sense. You know, he knew art history like none of his friends did. Like, they didn't know who these people were. In fact, Betsy Sussler talks about this interaction that he saw in the film when he goes out there. He says these people were so upset. Matta Clark, afterwards would say, of course I don't want their bit of land, but he would never dream of saying it to them. He would assume that they should assume that he doesn't want their land, but he would never actually console them. So he had this, but this idea of being landed gentry, he didn't really want to be landed gentry, but there was a sort of a funny version of this dream, according to Jane Crawford, that sort of, he was still invested in. And to be landed gentry in this way, especially if you can't even see your land or use it or be able to access it, this was of interest to him. Pointing the finger at the institution, in some ways, I think, no more, no less than in a lot of his other work, maybe. One of the things that takes him away from this project, by the way, is that, his career starts to take off big time in 1973. But then in 1973, right, or is it early 74, he does Day's End, which is an illegal intervention he makes off a pier in New York City, and he gets sued by the city for breaking into this enormous place and just doing this piece where he cuts out part of it. And he actually flees to Europe and comes back in 75 when the lawsuit is dropped. So his career takes off, but also he's actually fleeing the law. So by the time he comes back in 75, he's sort of moved on a little bit, I think, from this project. So, yeah. Yeah.
I was sort of thinking back to that presentation that essentially takes the point where you talk about the past forms, Roger's non-places. And I was actually thinking that in an interesting way, and the question I initially wanted to ask, I simply not answering it myself, which was the disjunction between property and land as one of the sort of most tangible commodities that exist, and the way in which representation has to be the modality of actually demonstrating them in the art gallery. That it becomes a different kind of commodity than the seller. But what I ended up thinking was that, of course, that in Auger's definition of non-place, the non-place is something which is in fact defined by contracts, by texts. And so, in an interesting kind of way, these very strange capitalistic residual spaces end up being really good examples of supermodernity and stronger than an example of that is the airport, which is his favorite example of that. But I guess the question that I was interested in then was your relationship to that legality, to that contractual status. And particularly, given that the licensing of this asks you to keep a paper relationship to it, which will get really ironic, I was wondering if there's any point at which you're actually considering provoking having your license revoked.
Yeah, we got the licenses, we renewed them year after year, and actually last year we sent them in to be renewed. They never sent them back to us. And sad to say, we didn't follow up. I kind of felt like, I can't believe we got away with it for so many years, so we don't have them anymore. I don't think we have them. And they might be in limbo in some legal way, too. I don't know what the status is. But certainly the license ran out, in December of last year, and we don't have a new contract. Legality. I mean, it was the idea of buying them was so thrilling to us. I can't tell you how thrilled we were that we could possibly buy these things. And part of it is such a petty thing that it's almost embarrassing to bring up. But part of it was just owning them was very, very, very interesting to us. And then owning the ones that Matta Clark had owned was doubly interesting. So we did, I think, a pretty good job of not being hagiographic about Matta Clark. He's a very charismatic figure, and we did our best, I think, and I think we succeeded. But the thrill was one of the places where we kind of doubling in his footsteps was interesting to us. That's not a very good answer, I know. Yeah, thank you for the references. Those are great ones, and I have to think about them some more. Aaron?
Could you talk more to the issue that you had voiced in class today?
Politeness?
The politeness with which you interact with the various colleagues among
them. Yeah. So Aaron's reading in class today brought up a number of dangers for museological practice. And one of them, in the text you'd read, what's the name of the text?
In the interview of Richard Sennett, he is concerned about the rise of civility and politeness in territorial and museological practice.
Yeah. So before I'd even sort of, come to the class, the first thing I said to Aaron, once I got off the train, was that reading this is part of the disappointment I was talking about. There are places here where the contradictions and the kind of the ways in which the story, this narrative has been constructed are so obvious, and we don't actually follow them up the way we should have. Some of it is just, you're understaffed, you don't have time, etc. But I know the places here where, out of a sense of civility and politeness, we didn't follow up. And, these are people who have been very nice to us, etc., lending us stuff, giving us their time, and they say something, and I know the places where we backed off. And there you go. Public confession of these moments of civility. And now, looking back at a couple of them, I wish we had not done that, Some of them would have been gratuitous, but some of them were important intellectually to include. And we didn't do that, so. There we go. Feels weird to have confessed that in public.
In answer to a couple of the comments that were just made, your response that he had this kind of layered gentry fantasy behind it is kind of disappointing, because I wanted there to be another political story. Landed gentry in England is formed in part through enclosure, through this arbitrary deciding that commonlands no longer belong to everybody, just to a few people. And I want this to be a story about that. I mean, it is 1973, and there's a lot of interest in Native American issues, Native American rights. And so the idea of this piece of paper somehow giving someone the right to say, this is mine and not yours, I want this to be about showing the absurdity.
I think it is. I mean, I overemphasize the other side just because we shouldn't forget that there was a minimal, at least, investment for him. This idea of being landed gentry had some minimal. Jane Crawford, I think, used the phrase, he wanted to be a gentleman landowner in some way. Somewhere in the back of his head, this myth wasn't something that had completely, surpassed or dropped. But I think it is also that. I mean, it was a joke about, in America, anybody can own land, here you go, I have all these bits of land, or some such. I might have overemphasized one half of this dialectic just to kind of make sure we don't forget that investment that he had on the other side. But for sure, I think there is that too. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thanks.